this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan, opening today with a very fitting and special song. That's the Harlem Boys Choir sharing Let There Be Peace on Earth. It was a song that many of us gathered together to sing at the end of a vigil last night on the Capitol Square, the second such vigil we've had to have in recent months, the first in response to the shootings at Oak Creek, at the Sikh Temple, and of course last night responding to events on Friday in Newtown, Connecticut. We had scheduled for today a show to discuss the morality, the consequences of drone warfare, and we still will engage in that subject because I think as we've been talking this through, we realize there's a great resonance with that and with our responsibility as adults to understand the implications for war, for gun violence, for so many other things that are connected to the basic safety of our children, to their future. But we also want to recognize, of course, the significance of what happened on Friday and your need as an audience to connect and to be in dialogue about all of this. So please take our invitation seriously. If there are things that you'd like to share related to any part of our discussions or just related to some of the greater meanings behind what happened on Friday. In the spirit of that vigil last night, and it was an incredible event, and I know two of our guests on the panel will be talking about were there, and we'll share more information. We want to start the show just by bringing in a local activist, and Chaos is on the line, I believe. Chaos?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you.
So good to have you here. We had a chance to talk after last night's vigil, and you were telling me about a very worthwhile project, one that seems especially relevant and compelling given recent events. You're working on a toy drive for local children who are homeless, is that right?
Yeah, we call it Santas Without Chimneys. And, you know, there's a lot of programs out there that really help the low income and the homeless, but the problem is that the homeless people actually have to get to these places to pick up the toys. If you're homeless, a lot of times you can't make it. So what we're doing is there's over 1,000 homeless kids in Madison alone. I don't know how many in Dane County. So we're trying to gather at least 1,000 toys, and when we get them, we're going to wrap them and deliver them to all of the homeless children on Christmas Eve at night so that when they wake up, Santa will have found them.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea. And we'll before we leave you, we'll make sure we get a sense of how folks can get back in touch with you. As somebody who experienced that vigil last night, though, just wanted to reflect with you briefly. I think one of the powerful things that we discussed as folks who are advocates for people who are experiencing mental illness was that of the two dozen or so speakers last night, I think at least half the folks talked about in a very compassionate way one of the responses that we need to have Friday is to have a better understanding of mental illness, to destigmatize it, but as a bottom line, to put the resources that are necessary to allowing people to have effective treatments that allow them to live the lives they need to live. And you know, as you work with folks who are homeless, of course, not everyone experiences mental illness, but that is a common thread in many of those lives, is it not?
Oh, yeah, definitely. My brother is a paranoid schizophrenic, and he was homeless. And if it wasn't for the diligence and the hard work of my aunt, you know, he very well could have been someone who shot people.
I remember you raised that last night. I think other folks did. And, of course, we want to put also out there that folks, statistically speaking, who have mental illness are probably less likely to commit violent acts. But that is a reality. That is, of course, something that is that's one of the threads of many of these recent incidents, that it was someone that clearly needed help but wasn't able to get it. Chaos, I apologize, but we've got a full show, and we want to make sure that we give our other callers, a chance to weigh in today. And I have a feeling there may be especially intense interest today. But could you give us, to finish off, this great toy drive idea, how do folks get involved? How can they help? How do they reach you?
Okay, yeah, real easily. They can go through Autonomous Solidarity Organization. You can find them on the web. Also, if you're on Facebook, you can also message me directly, Chaos at City Worker Riddle. And if you want to just drop off the toys, we have several collection sites, which is the Labor Temple on Park Street, both rape crisis centers on Coho, and I believe that's on Park Street also, the Fountain Bar on State Street, and the Tenant Resource Center at 1202 Williamson Street, and the Red Dragon Cultural Center, 109 East Lakeside Street.
So a bunch of different places, but let's do those top two again. So the website again, you Google Autonomous Solidarity, is that?
Yes, Autonomous Solidarity Organization.
Okay, and your name on Facebook again is for folks who are trying to find you that way.
Chaos, that City Worker Riddle.
Okay.
Chaos.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us and for being able to share with our listeners this wonderful project. And
thank you for letting us talk about it.
It was also a pleasure and a privilege to spend part of the evening with you last night. What a wonderful coming together community that was.
Yes, it was, and he's going to keep doing that too once a month.
That's right. Yeah. We should mention that. Yeah, the third Sunday of every month now at 6 o'clock. Given, unfortunately, the pervasiveness of this phenomenon in our society, Kellen Hardy, who's one of the organizers, has announced that we'll gather in a similar fashion on the Capitol Square. All who want to. Chaos, thanks again, and have a great week.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. And just to reset the show for those who are just joining us again, this is a public affair on Wart Community Radio. 608-256-2001 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation. Very pleased to have in studio. I apologize for not introducing you at the top. We have three distinguished guests, all working in the realm of peace and social justice, both locally and worldwide. Bonnie Bach is here. She was one of the original presidents of the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, also involved with the United Nations Association, which is an interest that we share. Linda Ketchum is here, also somebody who wears many hats, and today I think both as executive director of the Madison Urban Ministry. Is it Greater Madison?
Madison Area Urban Ministry.
Madison Area Urban Ministry. I see Bonnie shares this, you may all share this, but also a parent who's thinking very much about recent events and effects on our children. David Sumas is also here, and he is involved with No Drones Wisconsin, actually, as is Bonnie, and also a member of Veterans for Peace. Linda, you were sharing something just as we were going on the air, I think, that I think brings us home. Our emphasis throughout this hour is to talk about some of the things that affect our children. And this is in the realm of war and violence, whether it be drones or things close to home. But, of course, for many folks who are parents, who have children of elementary school age, and you have a 7-year-old, this hits especially close to home. Could you convey the story of this morning?
Well, as I was dropping my daughter off at school, she's a second grader, and the kids were being led in directly into the school building, and one of the other parents asked one of the teachers, the principal and vice principal, many faculty were on the playground, and unfortunately, for what I think is now the fourth time in the last 2 years, the school staff in the morning when they got on grounds found ammunition scattered on the playground. So they don't know who, they don't know why. The children obviously weren't told why they were going right into the school, but it nonetheless, it was disturbing the first three times it happened. It was especially disturbing this morning. And I talked with quite a few parents just on our way back to our cars who were tearing up and having a really hard time leaving their children at school this morning.
As a parent, what messages have you tried to share? What strategies have you taken in terms of the pervasive TV coverage?
Because I have some personal issues with that myself, but we've kind of at seven, we've not had that on in front of my daughter. But we have talked a little bit about what happened. We've talked a little bit about the fact that her teacher, she's safe at school. And Bonnie Augusta, who I think spoke at the vigil last night, was very apropos in talking about the fact that teachers are trained not only to handle these situations. My daughter's school, sadly, they have two drills a year about what to do and where to hide if there is a stranger in the building. You know, we talked to her about you can trust your teachers, and when your teacher tells you to do something, and that's what the importance of those drills. So we've talked a bit about it. She understands that children were killed last Friday in school, and that it has made us all very sad, and it made both Mommy and Mama cry.
Yeah.
And that it's okay to cry, and that it is scary. And so if she wants to talk more about it or has questions that were there, and she can also ask her teacher about questions. And I just want to say in terms of Bonnie's, our experience as parents with the teachers, I have no doubt in my mind but that either of my daughter's teachers would lay down their lives to protect their children.
Yeah, so. Yeah, such a powerful evocation of what happened on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
We were also remarking on something that's been going on. It's been placed on Facebook. It's remembering the words of Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, and he was sharing with children going through a difficult time. His mother's words of advice that there are helpers in your life, adults, referring to teachers or others. So it's again to emphasize that, but to also bring into the picture all of you. Again, our emphasis this hour is to figure out all of the different ways that we can be helpers. The phenomenon we're talking about have been going on for years, and we can make excuses about institutional barriers, about political pragmatism, but what we want to emphasize today is the message for our children. We need to do something about these things. We have a caller on the line, but if we could, we have a couple of callers on the line. I'm going to ask for their patience for just a second so we can bring Bonnie and David into the conversation first, and we will get to your calls. Again, 256-2001 is that number. Bonnie, we were talking on Tuesday night of this week about drone warfare. I think one of the things that was especially compelling was to think of the kids in the Gaza Strip or in Afghanistan and the buzzing overhead, not only the threats that they face, the kids who died because of drone warfare, but this is presence in their life they don't need.
Exactly. What we really have, I think, is sort of trickle-down violence. We're ending up with the use of force as being our first way to respond to problems, to conflicts. And I've been especially concerned about the issue of drone warfare for about the last year especially.
Bonnie, I think we're having trouble hearing you. Let's try this mic if we could.
Okay.
Yeah, then we got you. So if you could start again, sorry.
Okay. I think one of the issues that we have and that we as a country don't want to admit to is that what is happening is trickle-down violence. We have the world's largest military. We are engaging in drone warfare. The CIA especially is doing it in Pakistan, which is not a country we're at war with. And yet, we probably most of our population doesn't know that 176 children, as best we can tell, have been killed by drone warfare in Pakistan alone. And we're doing this in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, Somalia, and probably other places. So we need to look at why it is that why we're willing to spend half of our income tax dollars on the military. And the trickle down, you know, we're militarizing our police. They have SWAT teams. Some of them have tanks. They're talking about getting drones. They use the weapons of war like sound grenades, pepper spray, tear gas. And it's not surprising at all that individuals, especially it seems to be young men, somehow get in their head that they can solve problems or they can do this. And I think it's such a tragedy. And I think unless we start looking at all of our violence and making the connections, there was a wonderful line, I think it was in the first Gulf War, when somebody from the Middle East Council of Churches said, "We will have peace when we love our children more than we hate our enemies."
Yeah. No, excellent way to begin our conversation here. David Sumas, as Bonnie's talking, you know, thinking back to Tuesday night, and you all have a replica of a drone that you bring, just to kind of bring home the point about what this is all about. Actually, I wanted to start in a slightly different place for you, because I think of folks like Mike Bain, Wally Williams, and other folks that I've known through different Veterans for Peace groups. And I think, resonant with what Bonnie's saying, so much of their motivation as peace activists is to think of the children that they encountered, both in their time of service and their time since then. Is that a motivation for you as well?
Well, definitely. You know, one of the things that we do as a group is to do counter-recruitment in high schools. You know, the military themselves are pretty, you know, in a lack of a better word, rampant within the high schools. You know, they have full range of facilities. They go in and they try to recruit kids into the military. And we try to counter that and offer different alternatives to the military service, you know. It's kind of difficult nowadays with the economy being what it is, for kids to get out of high school, especially without a further education like in tech school and stuff, to find a job. It's extremely difficult. So, you know, there's a lot of kids, we call it an economic draft, end up in the military, for lack of anything else that they can do with their lives. So it's, you know, that part of it is extremely important. And, it was a year or two ago, I had seen these model drones, just to get back on that drone subject a little bit. And I felt that it would be a really good tool to get people, to see it and bring them around. It just kind of attracts people, and it attracts kids, especially younger kids. And it does give us an opportunity to talk to them and explain to them what the reality is of these drones. I mean, they look cool. It all looks cool. It's high-tech stuff, you know, robotics and all that, which, you know, as you know, if you're in technical stuff at all, it seems pretty fun and all.
Yeah.
But the reality of the fact that they are doing what they're doing, you know, killing people, killing humans, and if you can present that to the kids, you know, you have to do it tactfully. You know, you can't just put it out there. But, you know, and I notice a lot of the parents, when they bring their children around there, they do talk to them, and it's very important to have the parents explain to them what's going on with these drones. So it's a nice tool to use, you know, to help.
And another example of our militarism is that whole thing of the military in the high schools. They have an $8 billion budget to do recruitment, and under No Child Left Behind legislation, every high school is required to give, unless they opt out, their parents opt out, they are required to give contact information about students to the military.
Yeah. Just something else I wanted to remember from Tuesday night at the UN Association. I think you were talking about some of those young people grown up who maybe had been interested in video games and gotten fascinated by the technology, who are now running those drones remotely, often from a great distance.
Yes.
And for many of them, the trauma they're facing is they realize the implications of what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, if you can just kind of visualize what you're doing, you know, like when you're, you know, my own kids played them. I hate to admit it, but it's a fact. You know, their kids are attracted to the video games and any PC games and stuff. It's just something that they just gravitate to.
Yeah,
it's like it's almost a natural thing for them to do that. And I think a lot of it is just it's almost hypnotic. So they get drawn in, and it's something that they can do. And some of the games now are actually, they have headsets and microphones, and they talk back and forth over the internet as they're doing this, and they play as teams. What's interesting about that, it's exactly the way the military itself is set up when you go out on, you know, with squads out into in a war zone. That's what they do.
Wow.
So, you know, it's very realistic. So then it's easier for them to go from that point into, like, the drone warfare, and the military is recruiting drone pilots at a higher rate than regular aircraft pilots. Mm. And there's even schools, some of the universities are starting to offer courses and stuff like that in piloting drones. So it's something that's growing, what I think is at an alarming rate.
Yeah.
And, you know, we went from, I think just a couple of years ago, there were 40-some countries that had drones, and now it's over 70. It's becoming pervasive, and it is. Panetta and President Obama put a report out about a year ago about the 21st century military, and it's going to be based on drones and robotics, and that's where it's going. A lesser part of it will be on men on the ground, boots on the ground, but it'll be the robots and stuff, which, you know, then, you know, we can delve into what that means, you know.
We do have callers, is that right, Martin? Okay. Actually, several callers, so we want to honor them. It's something else we want to make sure we come back to, which is a theme, I think it runs its way through this, is whether it's drone warfare or the debate around guns. Very often we hear these pervasive messages. Well, that's, you know, anyway, we hear a squelching of dialogue about this, about debate. In the case of gun violence, I think we hear that, well, the powers that be are too powerful. The NRA isn't going to allow us to make any headway on this. And I think those are things we have to challenge, and that is something we'll come back to again throughout this hour. All right. We have, if we could, with each caller, if you could please give us your first name and your comment, your question. Go ahead, please.
Is that me? This is Thistle.
It is. Go ahead, please, Thistle.
Okay, yeah. I follow a few feminist blogs, and they have been commenting on the tragedy that happened on Friday. And I was just wondering if people could brainstorm with me and think about with me about the implication of it. It's usually a man who is carrying out these really awful acts, and what we can do, not hating men, feminists don't hate men, but just being able to look at that fact, isolate it, and think about how we can move into a future where we're training men and socializing men to be lovers and community supporters rather than having these feelings that pent up, you know, that are pent up and then result in an action like this. So I just would like to hear what people's thoughts about the fact that this is a gendered thing, and you know, the U.S. military is very male dominated and male focused too, and so it's like maybe empowering women to be in leadership positions and in positions of power in our society would also be part of the solution looking to the future. So I'll hang up and just listen to what people have to say. Thank you very much for having this program. Thanks.
Thank you for your call. Bonnie?
Well, Gloria Steinem, after the Columbine shootings, raised this very point, and she's pointed out that at that time, and I still think it's true, there have been no young women and no people of color that have engaged in these kind of random mass shootings. And she saw that as part of the way we have trained males to feel, A, they have to be superior, or else, you know, they're being disrespected. And also just the whole thing of how I think we still too much teach men to be stoic and not express their feelings. Now, the most hopeful thing I see is how much men are involved in parenting, because I think that might make a very big difference in all of this. But it certainly is true that we really have to get rid of the patriarchy.
Linda, as we talk about this, it reminds me of some of, I think, the things that you encounter in your work with reconciliation, with justice issues in terms of folks who've been in the correction system, hearing people like Jerome Dillard talk about, I think, the pressures the young men are under. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of things, sometimes after they come out of the prison experience, there's a chance for them to re-examine those mm-hmm. aspects of themselves. Again, we're not, as the caller is really kind to note, we're not anti-male here, but yet there are certain challenges that men face.
Well, I think Bonnie touched on it, the whole socialization process, and that we still, sadly, offer boys and young men and grown men less of a range of emotional expression. And so there are those men for whom things will become pent up. I think there is also, quite frankly, from what we see in the court process, that the court to some extent reinforces some of that when you look at the amount of domestic batteries that happen in our community and the very light sentences that men get for the first 15 or 20 times they batter a partner. And I think that that's a subtle message that is sent. There are interventions that are can be effective with men who batter. I think Bonnie mentioned, I saw, off the top of my head, I'm trying to remember, but of the last 60 mass shootings, and this is across, I believe, across the world, 43 were perpetrated by white males and one by a woman.
Yeah.
And that yes, it is pervasive, and especially in this country, I think the D.C. sniper might be the only exception to that in this country in terms of race.
And it defies the stereotypes and the conclusions we jumped mm-hmm. to, like in Oklahoma City, where we assumed it was
right.
Someone from abroad, but it was somebody right here.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, yeah. It gets into all sorts of biases, because I think we also, many of these are perpetrated by people who would define themselves particularly as Christian.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have all these, there are all of these issues that enter into it. And I think it's this whole idea of American exceptionalism as well that yeah. gets into it. I mean, I think, but I think Bonnie's right too in terms of the parenting stuff. I think to try to offer our young men and our boys an opportunity to, and What Happened Friday is a perfect example, to let them cry, to let them grieve, to let them know that those emotions are normal.
Yeah.
And, you know, so much of what is anger is often, and that rage is often that sadness and depression that's been suppressed and pushed down.
256-2001 is the number for callers. Please be patient with us if you could. David, I wanted to give you a chance to respond, and we will get to your calls, but please do be willing to hold on for a little bit as we continue this conversation. Go ahead, please, David.
Yeah, as a man, I just wanted to make a couple words here, but I first of all, I want to say hi to Thistle. you know, we've talked quite a bit, actually. And, you know, as a man, I know when I grew up, now I'm in my 60s, so perhaps things have changed a bit, but I don't really see it. But I know when I was growing up, I grew up in kind of a smaller town. And, you know, I can remember, you know, like every once in a while something would happen, you'd cry, you know, and my dad would be like, hey, buck it up, you know, be a man, you know, what's the problem here, you know? And they kind of stifled that emotion from coming out, so you kind of hold it in, okay? Which, you know, when you hold in any kind of emotion, it doesn't help you, you know? You have to let the emotions out. You have to let it flow. So even with, like, what happened Friday with the grieving process, you know, you can see that people wanted to cry. They wanted to do whatever, men. Mm-hmm. And they were holding it in. You know, maybe at some time it was released, but if you don't release it, it just creates additional problems and turmoil within yourself, right? And I had mentioned it earlier, and I mentioned it quite a bit. I think here in the United States, one of the things what I call is the John Wayne mentality.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the men have to be this rough and tough guy running around. So, you know, and that's kind of pervasive within our society, that men have to take that manly, you know, so-called manly role, the, you know, the warrior and all that kind of stuff. And what's interesting is that there's a lot of men that maybe aren't exactly that, right? You know, not all men want to be a warrior. Not all men want to be. Some want to be a ballet dancer. Maybe they want to be an artist or a writer or whatever, and teachers and stuff like that. And I've seen it over and over within, you know, when I have four kids that went through school, and they're all older now. But while they were in school, a lot of the kids were constantly being picked on by other kids because they wanted to be a ballet dancer and they didn't want to be on the football team, for instance. And you find that a lot. So you see a lot of these kids that are having issues or have been bullied in the past. They're not allowed to express themselves as individuals so much. And I think, you know, it's something that we have to really look at very closely and allow people to express their feelings and mm-hmm. express themselves as individuals instead of stifling that and holding them back, you know.
Forgive me, we'll give you a chance to comment on this later, but I think the other thing that strikes me in talking to other people involved with Vets for Peace, I think even uncle who was involved in World War II, who could never share the nature of that experience with his family. Yeah. And yet, with each successive generation, each successive conflict, I think folks have been able to open up more and more. The healing has come so much faster because of that.
Well, yeah, and we're actually, as veterans now, I think we're kind of pushing that for that,
you
know, for people to express themselves and to be able to talk about what's going on. You know, I was 14 years in the military, and I saw a lot of guys. You know, I was in Vietnam, and there were a lot of guys. I talk about what I've seen, and I wasn't a combat soldier, but I saw enough that, you know, I know what I don't like to do, you know. And a lot of people, including my dad, he was in World War II, they held all that stuff inside of him. My dad was, I know, has seen some horrific things when he was in the war and had to do things, you know. But he never did ever talk about it. And they hold that inside of themselves. And it causes people to act out, you know, with PTSD and stuff like that. You know, if you don't express it, if you can't talk to somebody and get that emotion out of yourself, it creates, you know, the issues where you have people going off, you have violence in the streets and stuff from veterans.
Absolutely. We're already at the halfway mark, but I want to make sure we get a few more callers in, and we'll give you a chance to join us in a second. Martine, how many callers do we have? Okay. Our next caller, your first name, if you could, and your comment, your question, please.
Thank you. My name is Jim. I think part of this needs to be, we need to be reminded that President Clinton imposed sanctions that killed over 500,000 children in Iraq, and there was no tears, those children and their families. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bonnie. Do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, it is part of, again, our militarism. We dehumanize and make somebody into an enemy, and then somehow it's okay to do whatever because, you know, we're the good guys. And what happened in Iraq, I mean, is horrific. We not only had Desert Storm, we had 12 years of sanctions, and now we have had 10 years of war, and it's not over. We still have mercenaries. We still have private contractors there. And it has just destroyed the population in so many ways. Depleted uranium munitions are causing huge numbers of birth defects. And I've heard several people, Iraqis, who have been in the U.S. talk about things. And mothers there don't ask, what is it? They ask, is it normal when they have a baby because of these horrific birth defects? And yet, we don't want to admit that we're doing this kind of thing. We want to close our eyes because, and frankly, it is hard. Once you know what it is that is being done in our name, it's pretty hard to deal with. And I think, therefore, we want to be in denial.
Yeah. Linda Kitchen, this whole idea of moral relativism, whether it's we see a death close to home versus one, a field maybe in not the same context, you see this, I'm sure, all the times in your work in terms of maybe sometimes discounting the experience or the life of someone who's mentally ill or someone who's mm-hmm. in extreme poverty, other things. How do we weigh that? How do we change that paradigm? It's powerful in some sense, to think of the transformations that may become because of what happened on Friday, that it was so close to home, that it was our children, and that may finally call us to action. But how do we make sure we have that same moral imperative for everyone?
I wish I knew. I think it is. I think we clearly as a country value some children more than others. We clearly as a country value some lives more than others. The value often relates to the color of skin, to the nationality, to the racial or ethnic group, religious group. Clearly, I mean, Chicago hit its 500th homicide of the year this weekend, but we didn't see the faces of the 10 people in Chicago who died this weekend.
Yeah.
We didn't see them on the news. We didn't see any coverage of that except a fleeting moment. The faces of the children who've been killed by drones, we don't see those on the news. So I think part of it has to be how do we look at using what happened in this country on Friday and helping people connect those dots that every child who is killed is someone's child, is someone's brother, is someone's sister, is someone's grandchild, niece, nephew. Every parent who's killed is still someone's child. So how do we get past those biases? How do we make those? And I think people of faith have a strong role to play in this dialogue and now pushing this apart, pushing this farther. Part of it is we value weapons. We value drones. We value military weapons. Look at our budget. Look at our national budget in terms of where we spend our money and where legislators want to spend money even when it's not being asked for. And look at how much money is spent lobbying for easy access to guns and how much money is spent on guns. Look at how much we value access to those guns versus the lives that those guns take. So I think this is very much a moral imperative, whether it's a budget, whether it's public policy, whether it's the lobbying that happens. But I think people of faith and I think the parents who were moved to tears this weekend all have a moral obligation to make sure that it's not just those 20 children we're grieving.
Just what you're talking about, I think, you know, struck a chord with what we heard last night, and that so much of how we're going to move past this is to gain an understanding of people who live outside our immediate circle. And you know, this was I think, demonstrated again in terms of the way the Sikh community reached out and taught us so many different lessons. The other thing, if I could first with Linda, just the thing to remark on with you, though, because I think we really want to extract the positives and the possibilities here, is to think as LGBT people. I know you and mm-hmm. I have both experienced in our lifetimes enormous changes in attitudes, mm-hmm. and that is at base just people getting to know us and recognize that we're their children too, as you said.
Well, and I think in some ways, I think part of the challenge for us as well is recognizing that we are relational creations, and yet our technology, again, whether it's drones, whether it's texting, whether it's Facebook, whatever, has allowed us to be separated and out of relationship, because quite frankly, texting is not the same as having that dialogue, sitting down face to face. And so while technology is a wonderful thing in many ways, I think it has also contributed to this general pervasiveness of violence, whether it's our military policy or whether it's what's happening in our streets on a daily basis. And you're right, it's when people build relationships, when they start. So when people go down to the day shelter and volunteer and meet people who are experiencing homelessness, when people volunteer at MUM with people who are returning from prison and realize that these are people who whose lives have value, meaning, and purpose and are looking for a second chance, that's where we can make change.
Please hold for just a second. We want to make sure we get our next caller on. If we could, caller, your first name and your comment or question, please. Caller, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Dan. There's so much to talk about, and it's obviously a really emotional issue. I just want to say that I think the base root of all this, and it's not just the commenter there you have in the studio that said that kids are somehow drawn to this. Well, it's been established. There was a group of MIT professors that scientists that went on a little excursion 5 days out in the wilderness without any technology. And they found out that it is very addictive. You know, it has to do with, I guess, parents being enablers. It has to do with, you know, the almighty buck in the pocket. It has to do with the violent video games that are out there that are so real. And, you know, it's not only that, it's the movies. You know, I knew of a tween and an eight-year-old that the parents let them go and see the Hunger Games. That's about kids killing kids. You know, and it's also the programmers at Sony that jumped off and created their own little program. It was like, I think they called it Columbine, about kids actually going into schools and so, you know, it's a deep-rooted problem, and it comes down to Hollywood, I guess, and the manufacturers of these games, and you know what the parents are thinking they're doing by throwing this pacification at kids. I mean, it's acute radiation disorder. It's a disorder. The technology is definitely an addiction. And they've labeled it as disorders or syndromes now. So, you know, it's real, but, you know, you turn your head away from it, and, you know, sure, children are, you know, being killed all over the world. And
caller, thank you so much.
It comes home like 9/11 when it touches base here, all of a sudden we wake up to it. Well, you know, maybe that's what we got to do.
Thank you so much for so eloquently expressing that. Bonnie, did you have some thoughts off of that?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with that caller, but I think that addiction to violence is real. But I think there's another thing that we also ought to name, and that is fear. I remember actually while Chuck Pfeiffer was director of MUM, there was a community dialogue, and it was pro and anti-gun. And in one side was saying they were afraid of guns because they could be used to kill and, you know, people would get at them that shouldn't have access. And the other side was saying they needed guns because they were afraid the police couldn't protect them from the bad guys. And I thought later what the conversation should have been is, okay, how can we figure out to take care of our fears? What are we afraid of, and how can we try to not be afraid? How can we fix the circumstances that cause that fear? And we don't want to have that conversation. And I think it has to do, again, with we're number one and we're the good guys. We can, you know, beat up anybody, so we won't be afraid.
David, do you think is it? I mean, I think Bonnie's right that we're afraid to have the conversation.
Yeah.
But is it also? I mean, there are powerful forces that don't want us to have that conversation.
Exactly.
Those are the forces we faced at the state capitol last year. Those are people that want to put the almighty dollar first to sell those video games rather than understanding what they're doing to our children. That's part of our battle too, is it?
Yeah, I mean, the whole society, our government, kind of creates that fear. I mean, if you look at, you know, when you go into any war or whatever's going on, even though it's not a justified war, I haven't seen a justified war yet. But they create demons. They're always creating demons. They're making us afraid. So like when 9/11 happened, you know, instead of taking that and using it to bring people together, all of a sudden it was a matter of vengeance, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're out demonizing all these people, which created a whole bunch of folks that were looking, you know, negatively on Muslims, all right? So then you have all that issue going on, and I have friends right here in Wisconsin that were afraid to go into the grocery store, all right? So you have that demonization of people, and it carries over, that carries over to throughout our entire society. I don't know, it might be a little bit off of where we are, but one of the things about a year ago, I was thinking about President Obama. You know, when he did his campaign for the presidency in 2008, everybody had this hope that it was going to bring about the change, and that was what he based his campaign on, about, you know, peace, ending the wars, all that kind of stuff. And it really never happened, but not did it not happen. What bothered me more was the fact that as a president who has the bully pulpit, if he were to stand up there once a week in his weekly radio address or whatever and talk about peace and love and forgiveness and compassion and empathy,
yeah,
versus spreading all this other stuff about how we got to get rid of our enemies, which in reality are not our enemies,
yeah,
people's minds would start to change. And that's what you have to do. You have to continue to put it out there. And I don't know, maybe I shouldn't get into this politics, but I have a very difficult time understanding, you know, when we know what's going on. Like if you look at what is happening with our government and the fact that we're using the drones and stuff like this in an election cycle, I have a hard time understanding how people can vote for somebody that is not professing peace and love,
yeah,
and instead brings upon war. You know, like even during his particular campaign, he stated right in the campaign that he would take people out of Iraq and then put more troops into Afghanistan. But as a society, when we hear this kind of stuff, it kind of condones the fact that we can use our military might or violence against people, and it just transfers itself into everything we do from a day-to-day standpoint.
You know, I guess what I'd offer to that, I think that gives me some hope, is that I think the conversation has changed. I think to juxtapose, during one of the debates that was held in Long Island, there was one person in the audience who brought up the notion of gun violence, and both candidates, of course, kind of obfuscated, didn't really go anyplace with it. There was a petition drive to get Lehrer to bring this in, in Colorado, for goodness sake, home of Columbine and Aurora, and yet there was resistance to that. However, so much of that is based on myth and fallacy, that the NRA is so all-powerful. Well, an analysis of their performance in this last election, they actually didn't do all that well. And you've got to dissect that. I can't remember the congresswoman's name, but her husband killed in the Long Island Railroad massacre of a decade ago, or 2 decades ago now. And that motivated her to become involved in public office. She just puts it on the line for her colleagues. You're dealing with non-reality. You know, yes, you have to show courage. Yes, you got to take some risks here, but it's not what you're saying. The conversation's all wrong. The equation's wrong. The public is behind all of this. So anyway, I think there's hope to extract there. We have one other caller we want to get on the line, and then we're going to be in our last 8 minutes or so we'll give you a chance to summarize the topic like this. The time really flies. But caller, your first name, please. Your comment or question.
Yeah. Hello, John.
Yes.
Yeah. My name is Methuselah. And I guess basically I wanted to go back to earlier in the program, my concerns about this gender stereotyping that I was hearing. First of all, I would like to make a correction. There was at least one woman that was involved, I believe it was in the 80s, in a mass shooting in San Diego, and I believe her justification was that she was feeling down because it was Monday. I don't remember how many people were killed or injured there, but there was at least one instance of a woman that was a perpetrator. In addition, I believe that women were indirectly involved in the Columbine shootings, in that girlfriends of some of the youth involved were fully aware and were videotaped attending practice sessions where the guys were shooting off their weapons. Another concern I have is that in the case of Adam Lanza in Connecticut, The guns were all registered registered in the name of his mother, and I think we're going to have to, I mean, the jury's still out, of course, but it will be interesting to see why a woman in an upper-middle-class area of Connecticut needed to have five weapons in her name. We've reached a stage in our society where we have women judges, women prosecutors, women police officers, women executives and companies, but I don't think that we have achieved as a result a more humane or compassionate world, and I think that point needs to be emphasized, and that we have to get away from this very convenient gender stereotyping.
Caller, we appreciate your perspective. I think, I know all of you, and I think this is the context we try to bring this up, was not to paint with a broad brush or to distance women from any responsibility in all of this. It was to say there is something for men that's an especially profound struggle in terms of this expression of emotion, this boxed up notion of how you're supposed to be. It's not a phenomenon that women can't express or other things, but men express it more profoundly. But there's no attempt to try to paint with a brush, I think. Linda, did you have some comments off of that or other thoughts? Sorry.
No, I mean, I know we're short on time, so I think part of what we approach things at MUM from a restorative justice perspective.
Yeah.
And part of that looks at when something happens, like Friday or any kind of crime. Yes, you hold the person who committed the crime responsible. You look at how do we try to heal as a community. But the third part that often gets overlooked from a restorative justice perspective is to say, what responsibility does our community or our culture have in creating an environment that allowed this to happen? And I think that's where we come back, whether it's looking at the use of drones, whether it's looking at the increased... Jeffrey Canada wrote a book in the, I think it was early 90s, late 80s, Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun.
Yeah.
He traced the evolution of violence in our culture, and particularly among youth, and discovered that, you know what, really the rates of violence don't fluctuate much. What has really changed is the lethality, and it is directly related to the access to guns. And so I just wanted to kind of bring that background. So I think as we are often wanting to say, well, we're going to have this conversation in so much of the media, what was wrong with Adam Lanza?
Yeah.
But I think what we really ought to be asking is, what's wrong with our culture? What's wrong with a culture that glorifies violence, glorifies death, ignores the deaths that are perpetrated in our name, and is willing to focus on this one individual as opposed to what we have set up within our communities and within our political process?
You're sort of answering this, but how do you answer that person that is a hunter, a gun collector, or believes strongly in the Second Amendment, who says it is people who kill people, not guns? How do we engage with folks who have those
people
beliefs?
Who don't have guns kill a lot fewer people. You can look at events in China. China has had a spate of attacks on school children using knives. But there have been very few deaths. I have a couple of cousins, Facebook friends, who are kind of very, very much kind of NRA. And one of the questions was, well, would it have made a difference in your position if someone or in this event if the person had a knife? Absolutely. You look at the lethality. Hunters don't. I mean, these aren't weapons that are used to kill animals. And if people want to tie it to a strict constitutional Second Amendment, then fine, use muskets. I have no problem with people having. Yeah. Everyone can have a musket. You know, if that's where you want to go with this. But the founders, the framers of the Constitution, could never have envisioned the technology that we have now. And so to say this has to be a strict interpretation, I think, is absurd.
And to invoke something, I think, unfortunately, it's appropriate in its graphic quality, but the semi-automatic weapon that pumped these children full of 10 or 12 bullets. What other possible positive purpose is there for that?
It's designed solely to kill as many people as possible, as quickly as possible.
We're down to our last 3 minutes. Bonnie and David, let me give you a chance for some final thoughts.
Well, I think that militarism is exactly what's also going on. And again, the trickling down. You know, the military starts it. It gets to the prisons and law enforcement, and then it gets to the people. And we need to change that. I want to invite also the callers to think about joining the vigil at Volk Field. This drone warfare thing has come very close to home. because at Wolkfield, which is in Juneau County, about an hour north, hour and a half north of Madison, we are now training drone pilots. And we are building, with about $400,000 from the state of Wisconsin, we're building an $8 million drone training facility. And I think that drones are a crime against humanity. I think remote control killing is another ratcheting up. We gather the fourth Tuesday of every month, except for Christmas Day, and from 3:30 to 4:30, you can go to WNPJ.org to get more information. The Wisconsin Coalition Against Drones, or to ground the drones, I should say, is working to try to stop that, and it's part of a national campaign. There are vigils and actions going on in Nevada, in Missouri, in New York, and I think it's a movement that really is trying to stop something that is a violation of international law and that really is targeted assassination, which this country ought not to be involved in.
So to emphasize again, those of you seeking action, there are two coalitions, I think, worthy of mention: Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, WNPJ.org, and, of course, also Linda's organization. And that website again is?
www.emum.org.
All right. David, I need about 30 seconds, but I just
moving forward. I don't know if I can do that, but have people take a look at our No Drones Wisconsin. If you search for No Drone Wisconsin on Google or whatever, it should pop up, and we do have some information there. And there's another real good site called No Drones, K-N-O-W, Drones, which can give you additional information. And just as, something I think about a lot is that as a nation, we need to soften our hearts. We have to question what our government is doing militaristically throughout the world and really look at ourselves and start getting a little bit more compassionate and, as humans.
We want to acknowledge and thank the contributions of all three panelists, Bonnie Block, Linda Ketchum, David Sumas. Thank you for all of your good work in the community. We're closing out Saturday Night Live, and its history has never opened with anything other than comic relief or other things, but on Saturday they made the choice to open with the children's choir singing this beautiful song, and it's a reminder to all of us that we need to do things differently. We need to take these threats seriously. We need to honor our children fundamentally in every way. And with those thoughts, we thank you and wish you all the best for a wonderful holiday season spent embracing and valuing each other, and hope that that will also be an incentive in 2013 to go out into the world and to do good things. This is a public affair. Have a good year and a good week.